The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
And just to prepare your minds, this is a very technical parsha and not so much philosophy, although I will bring in a lot of it is pretty straightforward Jewish values, but in terms of a bekiyut, so that we have a certain sense of the breadth of what's in Torah. And then at the end of this whole long list of items dealt with, I will put together some philosophical context that makes it into a cohesive experience. Okay. So Ki Teitzei starts off with a Jewish law, which is one of the more difficult, although there are more difficult than this to deal with, which is the concept of what's called an Eshet Yafat Toar, a beautiful woman. If, when you go to war and you are overwhelmed by the beauty of a woman of the nation that you're at war with, and they are taking prisoners of war, the Torah allows the Jewish soldier to take this woman home. Right? Now, of course, it's talking about he's got this overwhelming sense of infatuation for this woman, and he's allowed to take her home, but only under specific conditions. And of course, he can't marry her because she's not Jewish, and if he is to marry her, it will only be if, after this long process, she decides that she wants to be Jewish. But the long process is that he would shave her head. She would have to change her clothing. Very often they say that the women of the nation would wear very beautiful clothing to seduce the Jewish soldiers. So he would have to change her clothing so she wouldn't have this seductive garb. And he would have to let her nails grow, and she would cry for her parents, and she'd be at the door somewhere. He'd always see her back and forth. And of course, the specifications of this captured woman are so difficult that they are extremely discouraging. Right? I mean, you might be attracted, but within a short amount of time, when she's in your house and she's crying the whole time and she's not looking as beautiful as she was the day you saw her, the chances of anybody ever getting to the point where this woman would accept to be Jewish and therefore you could marry her are very small. Right? And yet, the Torah presents this case, right? And of course, our first gut reaction is, oh, this is disgusting, this is Judaism, I don't believe this is Judaism, this must have been put in another time, you know, period. So I don't know. But, so the Gemara talks about the basic concept in Judaism, which is, Barati Yetzahara, Barati Torah Tavlin. I have created an evil inclination, and I have created its cure, or its therapy, Torah. The Gemara specifically on this chapter in Gemara Kiddushim says that the Torah speaks to the Yetzirah of a human being. Okay? Torah speaks to the Yetzirah of the human being. Now this opens up one of the most important definitions of what Torah is. Right? Really crucial to understand. Very often people think that Torah represents the ideals of Judaism. Right? And therefore, when they open up the Torah and they see certain things that are in the Torah that just do not seem to jive with their moral conscience or their visions of ideals, they get very upset. And that's all based because you do not properly understand Torah. Torah does not always capture the ideals of Judaism. Right? Torah is a way to the ideals of Judaism. Jewish law, halakha, does not always represent the ideals of Judaism. Halakha means a way to go. That's what halakha means. And a way to go means you're here and you want to get to there. Right? So you have to understand that halakha is concerned with where you're at and where you have to get to. And therefore not all Jewish halakha represents the ideal of Judaism, rather the way to the ideals of Judaism. And that Judaism is written for a human being, with an understanding of the nature of a human being and the challenges of the human being, and is concerned with getting the human being from here to there. Okay? So therefore, does this mean that I see over here that the Torah says that I can take this captured woman? Does that mean the Torah sanctions such a behavior? No. It doesn't sanction the behavior. Rather, the very important thing to know about Judaism is it's realistic. It deals with where people are at, and it creates a system to get them to a higher place. Now, of course, although we would like to think that we're very sophisticated, and that always remains to be questioned, but you have to put this also into its time sequence. Even though we generally would not do that with Judaism because we believe it's timeless, but also timeless means that it's beyond time and relates to every period of time. And therefore we have to also have appreciation of where mankind was in those days also. Right? And not so much further are we today, because we do see and hear all kinds of disgusting things that are done in the time of war. And in a time of war, people's moral standards very often are looser, and they give themselves license to do things which perhaps in normal situations they wouldn't do. But let's face it, I mean, you know, wartime is not a normal time, and the challenges are very great, and the inclinations are very great. I mean, it certainly brings to mind all types of things. What's very beautiful to understand about what this parsha is all about is that Judaism relates to real individuals. Right? It relates to very real individuals. And in those days, this was common practice. Right? Common practice was to take a captured woman in a process of war. And not common practice amongst Jews, common practice throughout the world. Right? And it's probably something that happens even today. You know, they have this concept of war brides. These guys came back from Vietnam with a nice Vietnamese woman. It's not so unusual that there is that concept of taking this captured woman then somehow convincing you to marry you. Right? Or maybe even less than that, not even having you marry you, and yet you take them anyways. So you have to put it into the context of the reality. The reality is this goes on in the world. The reality is there's lots of things that go on in the world that we don't like. And Judaism relates to the reality because Judaism is a process. Right? Judaism is life. Life is a process of growth. And growth means I'm here and I got to get to there. And that's what Judaism relates to. And therefore this parsha, this paragraph, is not to sanction the Yetzirah. Actually, it's the most realistic way to deal with the Yetzirah. Because you can't say to people, don't do it, if that's the predominant consciousness of the entire world. Rather, we'll allow you to do it under conditions X. Right? To a certain extent, and this principle does not just apply to this little paragraph, this is a fundamental principle that really opens up an understanding of Judaism. Because there's plenty of things in Judaism that when you read them, your first impulse is, ugh, I can't relate to this. This is not moral. This is not me. You have to understand that by you saying this is not moral, this is not me, is the success of Judaism. Judaism would say, you know why you're saying that? Because Judaism has succeeded to advance human consciousness because it related to human beings and directed them from where they are to where they have to go. And therefore, yeah, you can say these things. Well, I would never do that. But you have to say, what is it that instilled within us that kind of moral conscience that says, I would never do it? Judaism would say it was the realistic approach that God had towards man. Right? And the Rambam, Maimonides, uses this principle in relationship to sacrifices, although that itself is a long topic. But he uses this principle in that sacrifices were the common practice of man in those days. And therefore, that was the mode of religious expression. If you were to say to the Jewish people that are steeped in a community which that is their mode of religious expression, you don't slaughter animals for sacrifice, this would not be realistic. And therefore, revelation relates to the people where they're at, and instead of what would be called cold turkey, right, and you get off the stuff like that, Judaism is a process. Halacha means you're here and you got to get to there, and it takes you there. Of course, not all halacha. Some halachas do express the ideals of Judaism. Others are a concession, what we would call a divine concession, with an eye for the future, how to get you there. And therefore, the laws of slaughtering, which we once talked about before, Judaism does not believe that human beings should eat meat. Right? In the Garden of Eden, they were only to eat, they were supposed to be, I guess, vegetarians, but certainly not eating meat. Right? And it was only after the flood that God conceded to man a divine concession out of a consideration for where man is at and how to get them to another place that man was allowed to eat meat. And yet even that is under certain stipulations in terms of what meat you could eat and not eat, types of animals, and then how you would prepare the meat. Okay? How would you prepare the meat? You know, the slaughter laws of Judaism is based on, very often people think, I mean, there was an attempt to prove that Jewish slaughter laws are the most inhumane, right? Because you're actually hurting the animal more, okay? And it is much less painful for the animal to be on a conveyor belt with some guy standing behind some booth pushing a button as it shocks these animals to death. Right? And that they're trying to prove, you know, I don't think they probably connect some kind of electrodes to the animal, and they feel they could measure the animal's experience of pain. And the whole thing was to uproot Jewish slaughter laws, as they were, you know, cruelty to animal. You know, you have these cruelty for animal societies against the Jewish people, and an attempt to prove that we're really rotten to animals, and this would be a much more humane way of going about killing animals. You see, we lack the understanding that humane means that you maintain the most humanness, right? It is much less human to be behind a booth pushing a button while animals are dying. There's no such thing in Judaism. If God allows us to slaughter an animal, then the shochet, the ritual slaughter, had to know exactly what he's doing. Every single time he slaughters an animal, he has to check his knife, that there's not a little niche in his knife. That's more humane. We could argue whether the animal has, you know, 10 degrees pain or 9 degrees pain, right? But Judaism is concerned about another element, which is that man cannot become cold-hearted in feeling completely comfortable in slaughtering animals for his consumption. And therefore, although God has conceded to man to allow us to do that, he also gives us laws that maintain as much humanness with a, so to speak, indication towards the future that this is not the ultimate vision of God. The man should be killing animals for consumption. Okay? So too over here. Various laws in Judaism do not express the ideal, rather the way to the ideal, as the Torah brings over here a real fundamental law that you have to know if you want to approach Judaism. It speaks to the Yetzer of man. Judaism relates to the base desires of human beings, with an understanding that that's where you're at, and with an understanding of where you've got to go. And therefore, although we're a little upset, perhaps, about this particular paragraph, it's not a mitzvah to take this girl. It is a permissible thing to do under conditions X, which with those conditions would minimize the possibility of him continuing on. Okay? And it's a much more realistic way of approaching people. Because if you say to people, don't do it, rather than do it, but under condition X and Y, it is a much more realistic way of dealing with people.
And it also gives the man space.
Exactly.
So he could come to his senses.
Exactly. Right, or she might decide that she really is interested in marrying him and she converts. Right, but whatever it is, it creates a context which is realistic. And that's very important if you want to understand Judaism. Right, if you want to understand Judaism, there's lots of things in Judaism that we might not be appealed, might be appealing to us in the 20th century. Right, but we have to understand that the fact that it's not appealing to us itself, Judaism would claim, is the success that Judaism has advanced human consciousness and moral standards. Okay, the next law that it talks about is that a father may not deprive the firstborn of their double portion. Right? In Jewish law, the firstborn gets a double portion of inheritance. Okay? Now what happens if you don't like your firstborn? You like the secondborn better. Are you allowed to do that? No. Right? Not allowed to do that. Okay? Even if it's the firstborn of another wife. Maybe you have two wives. Right? But your firstborn of this wife is not the firstborn of your life, so to speak. Still, you have to give the firstborn the double portion. Then it goes on to a law of a rebellious son. Okay? Ben Sora Morin. Now, a rebellious son is this son who two witnesses have warned that he shouldn't steal money, right? To buy meat and wine. And afterwards, they, in fact, observe him stealing money from his parents to go out and buy meat and wine, and they witness him eating this meat and drinking this wine in a real disgusting manner, like a real animal. And he's doing this in the presence of hooligans, right, real rotten guys. I mean, basically, they've noticed, now these are the details that express, you know, a kid that's gone wild. He's stealing from his parents. He's got this lust for wine and meat, and he's eating it like an animal, and he's doing it with a whole gang, or amidst a gang of hoodlums. Okay? And they warn him, and he's taken to court. Of course, the court has to go through the process of court, which is witnesses. But if somehow the final analysis is that, yes, the testimony is accepted, so he would get lashes. Okay? There was a concept in Jewish law, which it's still a concept, but we practically can't do it anymore, which is one of the punishments were lashes. Okay? What happens if, even after that, he goes out and does the same thing? Right? And again, witnesses see him and take him to court. Now, at this point, the parents take the kid to court. And if the verdict If the testimonies are accepted, he could be put to capital punishment. Okay? And the Gemara says, why? Better he die in the sin of stealing than die out of the sin of murder and stealing. Meaning that if this is the way this kid is behaving, right, I mean, it's really underhand. He's stealing from his parents. He's just really way out. That if he's got such a drive, then better stop him now before he ends up doing something even more disgusting and damaging his abilities in the next world, so to speak. Now, of course, this is something that, wow, that's pretty harsh. Right, that's pretty harsh. Well, as harsh as it is, the Gemara says that one of the opinions is this never happened, that it never will happen. The details of this particular case are of such a nature that it's completely a theoretical case. A complete theoretical case. Why then do we have in the Torah such a completely theoretical case? Because it has a lot of guidance in terms of our understanding of our children. How we have to realize that what you might be witnessing as a small thing happening now with your kid could end up being a very big thing, and you can't just say, well, it's just a kid. You know? It's just like, oh, you know, I mean, I was overwhelmed. I saw my child with her girlfriend, and we were in the fruit store, and her girlfriend stole fruit. Or actually, there was like all these nuts, and she stole these nuts. He ran out of the store and told my kid to do that. I was shocked out of my mind. I couldn't figure out how this little kid figured that out. I mean, how do you figure out stealing at such a young age? I'm really telling you that she was 4 when I saw her do it. And she knew it. And when we said, you know that's stealing? Because, of course, they go to Jewish school and they hear these kinds of concepts. And she went, she even had answers. Right? Really very frightening. So therefore, on a theoretical level, the Torah here is giving us guidance in terms of appreciating how acts that seem to be very small in the initial stages could really evolve into something very, very serious. Right? Very, very serious. Okay, but the whole beginning of this parsha is clearly dealing with family dynamics. And the oral tradition brings down that if a person marries a captured woman, which is a woman who really isn't that the best way to get married, then you'll end up having children that of those children, some of them you won't like because your marriage wasn't based properly. And being that your marriage wasn't based properly and your kids are not going to come out in the right level of kedusha, because, you know, in Jewish law, the dynamics of the relationship between the husband and wife will determine who that child will be. Right? And I was shocked. I just thought everyone would believe this. But I gave a class in Cleveland. There was a psychologist there. I was talking about the Jungian idea of personality traits as something that you inherit. And this guy didn't believe it. He didn't believe that a child is born with a personality trait. He believed that the child, and this is a psychologist, he believed that a child comes into the world with a completely clean slate, and personality is completely a function of the sociological context wherein the child is found and raised. Right? Well, I know that this guy's not married and certainly doesn't have kids. Right? Because I said to him, I don't care who you read, I don't care what experimentations you're familiar with, I can just tell you that Canaro with my 4 kids, they are so different, and I cannot see any difference in the sociological context or our relationship to them. They are so different, right? So different. And so you have to understand that really, you affect your child, right, before the child's even born, before the child's even conceived. The relationship, you know, if this is the type of woman you married with someone you just found, you know, in the war, and you take her home, and you know, if that's the dynamics of the relationship, then the Torah is hinting to us that there will be another scenario that you'll have to deal with, right? Which itself is the beginning of another scenario that you'll have to deal with, which is your son being rebellious, okay? So there's this kind of connection expressed between the beginnings of this parsha. However, it then goes into something that really is disconnected, although there's a loose connection, which is that there is a mitzvah to bury the person who's received capital punishment within that day. Okay? Now, there was a common practice in those days, right, not only amongst the Jews, but amongst the world, that when a person received capital punishment, what they would do is they would hang the dead corpse as a warning to all to recognize this is what happens. And like in certain societies, they would maybe put that corpse on a, you know, hanging there for days and months as it just rots in front of people. Again, to curb that, Judaism does allow for the hanging of, I don't think it's a mitzvah that, to hang the executed criminal, but you are not allowed to let the corpse hang overnight. All right, so this was really short. The practice of the Jewish people was that they would hang the corpse just before sunset, and then right after sunset bring it down. Why? Because our old tradition says that, remember, every human being is created in the image of God. Right? And therefore, could you imagine a king who has a twin brother who's been sentenced to death, and allowing the king's brother, the dead corpse, to be hanging there while people point and say, look at the king. Right? Look at the king. And therefore it is a chilul Hashem. It is a desecration of God. It is a desecration of the holiness of life that is potentially there. Okay? And so although, I mean, we might not be so interested in seeing a corpse hanging there, but I think we could imagine the impact it has. Remember, what Judaism will say in terms of capital punishment is not so you'll do it and this is what you'll get, right? But this is what you'll get so you won't do it, right? And therefore, you have to appreciate how the moral conditions of the Jewish community in terms of how many people got capital punishment. Hardly anybody in the history of the Jewish people, right? In the history of Jewish people, one Gemara says that a court that sentences once in 70 years, a Jewish court, once in 70 years is considered a murderous court. Another opinion says once in 700 years would be considered a murderous court. They must not be clear enough a court because the dynamics of judicial procedure are so precise it's almost impossible to get to capital punishment in Judaism. Right? Right. So, and then when you get something so outrageous, so then that should be used so that we never get to that situation again and people are warned enough that that doesn't happen. Okay. But I don't want to get into the whole debate of capital punishment. Anyways, then, and of course the loose connection is, well, after we talked about a son who could possibly get death penalty, then of course we do have a qualifying law that deals with, and yet there's still a sense of holiness to even the dead corpse. Okay? So there is some kind of relationship. However, the next mitzvah is a little more difficult to relate, which is the mitzvah of returning a lost article. Alright? A lost article. And of course, in a metaphorical sense, we could say, well, this son is like a lost article because we are all, so to speak, the children of God. We are all, so to speak, the property of Hashem. And when a person does not behave in a manner which is coordinated with the divine will, so they're lost. Right? And you have to return. Okay, so that'd be nice if we want to say drush on Shabbos after children. But right now, it's not Shabbos. So on just a simple level, of course, if you find something in the street, you have a responsibility to return it to its owner. Okay? How do you return something to its owner? You put up a sign where you found it, or in those days they had a public lost and found place. Right? Lost and found place. Where you don't deposit what you found, but rather leave a sign. I have found something, and you know, call and identify. Now, a person would have to call and say, I lost, or you could say, keys. Right? But then the person will have to identify what those keys were. The person, well, there was a yellow tag. You just tell me, what do the keys look like? And they have to say, there was a yellow tag on it. Ah, these are your keys. Okay? These are your keys. Now, what happens if you find something and nobody comes to claim it? Like, let's say you find a chicken. Right? And in those days that was quite common, I'm sure you could find some chicken hanging out and you don't know whose chicken this is. So you take it home and of course you put up a sign and there's nobody answers to chicken, lost chicken, come and claim. Now what do you do with this chicken? Right? You have to keep this chicken and feed it and take care of it until the owner comes to get it. It's unbelievable. Now what happens if it's something that by the time the owner gets it, it'll be dead? Right? Or if it was fruit, it'll be worthless. What you would do is then sell the chicken or the fruit and keep the money for the owner for when they come. All right? And those are the laws of returning lost articles. Yeah?
Isn't there something about if
like... Like yours. There is a point, I don't remember the time, if a person despairs, meaning that they've just given up on ever finding it. So then the next mitzvah is what happens if you see your fellow Jew loading their donkey or their Rolls Royce. Either one of the two. Right? And they're loading. And it's a burden, right? Of course, a Jew would help. And that's a mitzvah to go help this fellow load their donkey. Okay? However, you're allowed to ask for payment. Right? You're allowed to say, well, you know. But what if you see someone unloading their Rolls Royce or their donkey and they need help? Of course, you have to help them, but you're not allowed to ask for payment. Right? You're not allowed to ask for payment. Probably because it's not as difficult a job. Now, what happens if you see two people, right, beside each other? One's loading their donkey, one's unloading their donkey. Now, which one do you help first?
Unloading.
Which one?
Unloading.
Why? Exactly. You're helping the animal because the animal, as long as its burden is on it, right, you are easing its burden, therefore you're doing a greater mitzvah by helping the animal and the person. Okay? Now what happens if you see somebody unloading their animal and they're your friend and you see someone loading their animal but you don't really like them so much? Right? So then you are to actually help the person you don't like first so that you will overcome your dislike for them. Right, and begin to help them, because of course Judaism believes that one loves somebody when you contribute and help them. That's the only practical way to feel close to somebody.
And then your friend is angry at you.
Right. But if they're good Jews, then they'll understand that you must dislike this guy, and that's why you're doing it.
This is directly after the lost article and before the bird's nest?
Yes, yeah. No. Before the bird's nest, there's another law that you'll all be excited to hear, which is the law of a man may not wear women's clothing, and women may not wear men's clothing, and that also includes weapons, which is that a woman really should not carry a gun, of course, in certain situations. If she had to, then that's different. But that gets into the whole concept of women in the military service. Of course, a woman could be in the military service, but she should not be in the position of carrying a gun. Unless something, I mean, you know, in certain pikuach nefesh situations, she's got to have a gun, of course. That's not the point. The point is, you know, as a general rule, the people in the army are always carrying guns. A woman, according to Jewish law, should not be doing that.
Exactly.
Oh, so that's the point. The point is, if she's really in a real state of danger, then that would obviously not be, because any situation of pikuach nefesh would, of course, override. Simply, you know, who should go on watch in a yeshuv? Should the women be running, walking around with the guns, or really should be the men walking around with the guns? According to Judaism, it would be the men that should be walking around with the guns. What if it's a settlement of just women? So they say, oh, we're from, we don't have guns. Well, ridiculous. Of course they'd have to have guns. At that point, it would be pikuach nefesh. Okay. So, of course, that gets into all types of discussions, which is whether, according to Jewish law, a woman can wear pants. And of course, it's going to be difficult because who says that pants today are clothing of a man, right? Especially when you have pants that are designed specifically for women. Okay, so really the whole concept of women not wearing male clothing not necessarily applies to women wearing pants. Meaning from that point of view, it's very possible that a woman would be allowed to wear pants, according to some opinions. However, the other opinion would be that, but pants we don't consider modest. Right? It's not a question of wearing male clothing. It's a question of the type of clothing that is in terms of delineating the shape of her body would be not appropriate. And of course, at that point, we get into all kinds of discussions, whether what if they're loose pants, what if it's a culotte. And I don't want to get into it. Right? I don't want to get into it. Right? I can tell you that according to some opinions, if you're hiking, so to speak, and you know, and it will of course be less modest to be wearing a dress as you're climbing trees or something. So then there are opinions that would say, no, then a woman really should wear very loosely fitted pants. Or there are of course opinions that deal with, well, what if it's cold? Right? What if it's cold? So then there are certain opinions that would say, yes, but of course, you know, a woman could wear, what do they call them, leotards or... What are they don't call them anymore, that? Tights? What do they call them? Leo? I don't remember. Tights. Anyways, so you really could get around that too. Okay, but I don't want to get into it, so we go on. Okay, so then we get into another mitzvah called Shlichut HaKan, which is if you want to take the eggs of a bird, right, or its babies, in terms of like that's what people do when they're getting those, what do they call those little, in terms of chicken, you get a whole chicken, what do they call those? Doesn't matter. No, it doesn't matter. No, those are some people eat like chicken legs, but they're actually this type of, I forgot what they're called. Cornish hens, right? These little things. Anyways, the whole point, our vegetarian over here will be very excited about this. Anyways, the fact is that there is human consumption of animals. It's just a fact, Megan. Now, that doesn't mean that we're encouraging it, but the fact is that that's the way it is. Now, the question is, how do you relate to it? So, there's a mitzvah that you have to shoo away the mother bird. At the very least, you don't take away the eggs while the mother's there, at the very least. Okay? So, that's a mitzvah. Then there's a mitzvah to put up a fence around your roof. Meaning, you can't have an open roof if people go up there. Right? You're not allowed to. You must put a fence around a roof or a porch or a pit, if you have a pit. It's your pit. And you have to have a fence around it. And the fence must be at least 10 tfachim, which is around 40 inches high. Okay? Then it goes into the laws, certain agricultural laws. And of course, at the end of this, I will somehow try to bring some thread that will unify why this was all together. Brings in some laws of agriculture, which is, you are not allowed to plant grapes with anything else in the same field. Right? And saying, like, if you have a vineyard, you can't, in the middle of your vineyard, plant an apple tree. So that's a mitzvah. Here, and the sages say, also outside the land of Israel. The parsha then talks about that there are certain stipulations in terms of two animals harnessed together. Meaning, you know, in those days, of course, they had a yoke. And you're not allowed to put, for instance, an ox and a donkey together. One of the explanations, because their natures are so different in terms of their needs, that you would actually be bringing pain to each other. Okay? One of the approaches to understand it. And then it goes into you're not allowed to, and of course all this is dealing with mixing, making very strange mixes that are not permissible. There's something called shatness. Shatness is a problem. Not so much of a problem today, because it's just the garment district. But you're not allowed to put linen and wool together. Okay? Not allowed to put linen and wool together. And why would you put linen and wool together? Well, they do in very expensive suits for like the chest and for the shoulders. They would often put in something that's made from linen and sew it with, of course, cloth that is made of wool. You're not allowed to do that. You can also find it in a skirt if they want it, a certain part of the skirt they want to make more hard, like around the waist. Right, very often, just where the buckle is, they would just put a little piece of linen in there. Now, chances are not so great anymore because linen is very expensive to do that. But there is what's called a shotness laboratory, which is you would have to ask them what's the latest things that might have shotness, and they can test it in terms of seeing whether it has that. Right. Here in Israel, there are actually companies that are under rabbinical supervision that you can eat their clothing. No. they're under rabbinical supervision that actually has a tag that says no shotness. Then it goes into what's called motzi shemra, which is a man gets married to a woman and then he starts saying various things in terms of that he was fooled, that he was told that she was a virgin and she wasn't a virgin. And it goes into various laws of rape in terms of what happens if a man rapes a woman. Goes into laws of forbidden marriages. Now, you're not allowed to marry a mamzer. A mamzer is a person that is a child born out of, not out of wedlock, that's not so simple, but out of adulterous relationships. Okay? And you're not allowed to marry an Ammonite or a Moabite. You know, next time you go out. Just ask them, by the way, where's your family from? Forever. In other words, even if they were to convert, because this nation demonstrated such a cold hardness to the Jewish people that we cannot accept anybody that comes from that gene pool, so to speak, into marriage. But they could marry each other if they converted. Just by men. Yes, just by men. You're not allowed to marry an Egyptian, but after the fourth generation of their, you know, of a converted Egyptian who then married another converted Egyptian, they had a child, you can marry that child. So there's various laws in terms of who you can marry and who you can't. We go on. You have a mitzvah to keep your camp, and this is going back to a military concern, that the military camp had to be physically clean, right, and spiritually clean. They had certain laws as to the kind of spiritual purity that the person would have to be in, and if they weren't in, they would have to leave the camp until they were. Then it goes into really interesting law, as if these weren't, but this one really fascinating. Let's say your Canaanite servant, right, you have a Canaanite servant, runs away from you and seeks refuge in the land of Israel, right? You live in Manhattan, you have a nice Canaanite servant in your estate in Lawrence, in center Manhattan, and all of a sudden, your Canaanite servant gets on a plane and takes off, gets on an LL plane, and comes to Eretz Yisrael. You're not allowed to return him, right? You can't give him in. And that's amazing, because he's not even Jewish, right? But this is the most amazing thing, that the holiness of Eretz Yisrael has influence and impact upon any human being. And for any human being that comes to Eretz Yisrael, you know, this Canaanite who runs away from their master to come to Eretz Yisrael, that servant is not allowed to be returned to his master.
Where does it say freedom?
Well, the oral tradition qualifies. Yeah, I guess so. Seems like it. He can't return him to his master. I mean, if his master comes to Eretz Yisrael, no. At that point, the master would have rights, as far as I understand. You cannot get rid of him out of Eretz Yisrael and say, you got to leave Eretz Yisrael. And that's like a deep understanding to appreciate what Eretz Yisrael really means and how it affects any human being, right, in terms of who they are and what they are. And you can't send them out of Eretz Yisrael if they desire to come to Eretz Yisrael so that they should be by their master. If their master comes, then as far as I know, then of course, you know, they would have to, of course, return to their master. The last Canaanite servant I had to deal with was, okay, then it goes into various laws dealing with prohibition against prostitution, and presence of prostitution, deals with laws of not taking interest, deals with the laws of you've got to fulfill your vows, talks about certain laws in terms of working conditions. A worker who works for you in a field must be allowed to eat while he's working in the field of the produce of the field, but can't put it in his bag and take it home. Deals with divorce laws, deals with the laws of a man is in his first year of marriage, he's not allowed to go to war. Okay, he is exempt from war for the first year. Treating the widow with special considerations goes into harvest gifts for the poor. There's certain laws in harvest that you cannot harvest your entire field. You'd have to leave the corners for the poor to take, right? Or if you were harvesting your field and one or two of the things that you were harvesting, like you were harvesting and you had a bunch of apples in your hands and two apples fell down, you're now allowed to pick them up, right? You have to leave them for the poor to take on their own. And various laws as such for the poor. Then it goes into some specific laws into the terms of the punishment of lashes, which we talked about. The mitzvah of yibum, which is if a man is married and has no children, no, not a boy and not a girl, and he dies childless, then his brother has a mitzvah to marry his wife to continue his name. Okay? If his brother doesn't want to do it, then he's not forced to, and then the parsha talks about something called chalitza, which is a process which then nullifies that obligation. Okay? Goes into the prohibition of using false weights. And then it talks about, it ends off with the mitzvah to wipe out Amalek. Right? I think most people are familiar with, there is this enemy called Amalek. What makes them unique out of any other nation is other nations have taken war against us because of maybe financial considerations, out of threat or whatever, territorial concerns. Amalek was that nation who was out to kill the Jewish people just because they're Jewish, and that's all. Right? They just hate Jews. Right? They just hate Jews. Of course, today we don't know who Amalek is, and therefore Amalek at this point becomes theoretical. Right? But there is that mitzvah to go to war always, forever, against Amalek, no matter what. Right? Because this is a nation who has absorbed into themselves such incredible evilness that they just want to kill the Jews just because they're Jews. All right. Now let's see if we can put all this together in the next... how many minutes we have? Okay. Well, my research did not avail me that much in terms of putting every single detail together, but I think we can put together a context which will appreciate why we had such a spectrum of ideas, that if we were to categorize them, I'm sure they would really touch on so many various issues of daily living in and human dynamics, and laws that deal with man and between man, and laws between man and God, because, you know, the way I plant my vineyard has nothing to do with another man. It has to do with my sense of responsibility to God. So it obviously has samples of the laws between man and man, has samples of laws between man and God, has samples that deal with certain communal responsibility, samples that deal with marital relationship, family relationship. Right? It really covers just the whole broad spectrum, and you seem to get a sample of various laws that deal with just the daily living. And yet the question is, what is all this doing here? Why all of a sudden here? This really will be the last very technical mitzvah-oriented, enumerated in this parsha, 74 mitzvahs. In this parsha alone, out of the 613 entire book. So the question is, what are they all doing here? And this will be the last, well, not probably the complete last, I'm not sure of yet, but in terms of a body of laws, we're going to go more into philosophical. The last four parshiot is reminding the Jewish people of their vision and their ideals and their values in a much more general philosophical, ethical sense. But the technical side, this is going to be very much the ending. So what are these all doing here? Maybe Moshe got a little nervous. Ah, my time is running out. I got to fill in all the blanks that I didn't bring before. I mean, what is it doing? So remember, the beginning of Deuteronomy, the first three parshiot, dealt with a more philosophical introduction to the essence of the Jewish people, the dynamics of the land of Israel and the Torah and the nation. It then moved on to our first responsibility when we get into the land, which is to remove idolatry, right? Which is the antithesis of Jewish living. And then the next parsha, which was Shoftim, which is what we just did yesterday, is dealing with the establishment of leadership, okay? As the leaders of that national body called Am Yisrael. Now, what is this all about? Obviously, the name of this parsha is Ki Tetzeh. It starts off, and when you go to war. And generally, we attempt to see how the whole parsha is connected to that topical line. That somehow, whatever is in this parsha must have some kind of connection to what it means to go to war. What it means to go to war. And I saw a very nice piece that confirms this idea in a book by Rav Aviner, a contemporary rabbi. And he points out there's a very interesting Gemara that says that the book of Koheles was considered to be buried. Right? They were actually thinking of hiding it or getting rid of it because you couldn't burn it. So it's called Geniza. Right? It would be put away. Because when you read the book of Koheles, there are certain things in there that are so apparently contradictory that it really just begs for biblical critical approach, right? There's just such serious statements said there, and they contradict each other, contradict various values of Judaism, and therefore Kohelet is such a serious book. The Gemara says, why did they not in the end decide to get rid of Kohelet? And the answer is because it started with words of Torah, and it ended with words of Torah. Meaning it started with a complete dedication to Torah and Emunah, even though the middle of it seemed not to, and yet it ended with a sense of dedication to Torah and Emunah. And therefore, Rav Avivner points out that the beginning and the end tells us what the essence of the whole book is all about. Right? He therefore also points out in terms of this portion, that this portion starts off with war, right? What happens when you're in war and you see a beautiful woman? And it ends off with war, which is the war against Amalek. And also, right smack in its middle, deals with the laws of the military camp and the kind of physical spiritual purity it must maintain. And therefore, we see that somehow, in a funny way, this parsha is surrounded by its middle, its beginning, and its end, brings us back to a war consciousness. And yet everything else seems to have nothing to do with war. Right? Various details of common life and daily life and daily routine responsibilities, right? And it just seems like what does one have to do with the other? Anyways, based on that introduction, I would like to offer an understanding of then how can we understand what this parsha is all about. You see, I think probably the first and foremost manifestation of nationhood is war, or the ability to go to war, right? At the moment that you have an army, at that moment you are a nation. That doesn't mean that you have to go to war, right? But it does mean that the most striking expression of national existence is military ability.
Is that true in the case of Judaism? I mean, as soon as the Torah was given, wasn't it the Jewish nation?
Yes, it was a Jewish nation with a Jewish army. And every time the Jewish nation...
The Jewish army at the time of the Torah?
At the time of the Torah? They were counted according to army. They didn't have an army yet, right? But they had the ability to become an army. Now, you have to understand, what does army express? And everybody knows that army, generally, even today, army, you know, they shave their heads, right? And they all wear green, or they all wear a uniform, because army expresses the klal, the collective whole of, it is a manifestation of, the collectivism of nationhood, where the individual becomes submerged, and that doesn't mean that's our ideal, but that's the fact, right? Because of the need for that organic unity in the defense of your country, right? A country that cannot defend itself, not a country that can be offensive. That doesn't mean you're a nation. But let's face it, we are a nation amongst nations that are not necessarily friendly, and that's just being Jewish history. That's what it was, and that's what it is, and God willing, that's not what it will be, but that is what it is. And therefore, we have to have an army. An army is the most striking manifestation of national existence, right? National existence, the ability to defend yourself as a nation, right? Now, after we've set up, we've come into the land, right? We set up leadership. Of course, the next step is the appreciation of, or the manifestation of, leadership as a nation, which is an army. However, let's think about what this is all about. What does the consciousness of possibilities of war do to human beings? Very often, it diminishes their moral sensitivities. Right? Very often, it diminishes their moral sensitivities. And it's just a fact. What's done in war, when people are in a state of war, they do things that they never would have done. Right? They lose a sense of the sensitive to individuals, because war are not individuals. Individuals don't go to war. Nations go to war. Right? And the individual somehow becomes merged with some kind of body called nationhood. And of course, how does the individual feel in a state of war? Well, that's the interesting thing. When you're in the threshold, on the threshold between life and death, you do a lot of things that you normally wouldn't do. And not only that, but you might say you become slightly hefker, what we would call in Hebrew. Right? You become too free. And not only that, various responsibilities on the daily level seem to melt away into insignificant. I mean, while you're under war consciousness, do you have time to think about whether I return this piece of article or not? I mean, you know, it's just like seems insignificant. And that's the interesting thing about most of these laws here in this parsha. They seem to create a very strange contrast between when you're going to war, and yet within the context of when you're going to war, it brings up all these things that really generally are the things that people forget about when they're going to war. What does this mean? When you're faced with life and death, these things are insignificant. And you have to appreciate, this itself is something that I think is really very common even today. You know, amongst, not all, but a certain secular Israelis. What do you care about tefillin when we're standing before the possibility of complete national destruction? Right? I mean, how can you understand that? It doesn't make any sense, right? It doesn't make any sense that a Jew should care about whether his vineyard has another seed in it when we're standing before possible national annihilation. Doesn't make any sense, right? And yet that's exactly the sense that Judaism wants to make, right? That precisely, although Judaism has sensitivity to the challenges of being under the influence of war consciousness, being under the influence of threat, and therefore shows sensitivity towards that soldier and his challenges, his sexual challenges, as he takes for himself a captive woman, juxtaposed to all that are laws that maintain a balance of complete sensitivity to individuals. Right? Complete sensitivity to individuals. And so, that's the balance of Judaism. That's the balance of Jewish existence. You see, the interesting thing about Jewish existence is I don't think there were too many periods of history, if any, where it wasn't a period of life or death. Life and death. That's what it means to be a Jew. To be a Jew means you were always living a life threatened, national threat. And yet that was the amazing thing. The amazing thing is that when people are under the threat of life and death situation, they lose their sensitivities towards daily responsibilities and individuals. It was precisely in that context that the Jewish people would demonstrate such incredible sensitivities. Right? I mean, if you read, and of course there's stories, and there are stories of individuals, but I think these are really heroic individuals, stories of the Jews, you know, in the camps, right? And how they related to each other. An unbelievable quality of morality. I mean, it's unbelievable, you know, and generally in that situation, now we're going to all die anyways. Then, who cares? And yet it was precisely in those contexts where the Jewish neshama stood the test of what it really means to be a moral individual under the influence of consciousness of God. There's a story I once heard about a fellow who was, who the Nazis, you know, knocked on their door and said, okay, you're coming with us. And the first thing he said to them is, not until I feed my chickens. Right? And, you know, can you imagine, the Nazis, are you a nut? What do you care about your chicken when you'll be a roast yourself? And yet that was the consciousness of the Jew. That, no. Precisely in, life and death is where my moral sensitivities to the details of life emerge. Because it's always life and death. Because Torah is life. And all these various little responsibilities are life. And therefore I think it's ironic and beautiful that this parsha, which is talking about war, and seems to delineate and package the entire, all these various laws within the context of war and what war implies for human consciousness, and yet somehow the packaging doesn't seem to fit its contents. And yet I think that's exactly the point the Torah wants to tell us. Right? The Torah wants to tell us, yes, now that you're in national existence, and national existence means that you're dealing with big issues, right? Big issues of the possibilities of complete national destruction. And yet what happens in the final end? Right? The final end is you have to realize that that cannot damage your daily responsibilities and sensitivities. And yet Judaism has that balance where it empathizes with the challenges and yet still encourages that you maintain high moral standards. Right? And that's the fine line that Judaism always wants.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.